Welcome to the Brighton Book Club, a monthly show on Radio Reverb celebrating books and writing in Brighton and beyond. We are delighted to be partnering with the Coasters Queer Literature Festival to revisit some of their great events in the lead up to this year's festival, which will take place at ACCA at the Sussex University campus from the 10th to the 13th of October. The Coasters Queer is Brighton's annual festival of LGBTQ+ writing, the first of its kind in the UK. The festival creates a space for queer writers, readers and allies to come together in a celebration of the written word and its ability to illuminate and enrich the lives of our community. On the fifth and final episode of the series, we revisit 2023's closing event called Queer Ukraine, featuring Javichka Collective, Tanya G, Yelena Moskovich, hosted by Maria Jutskreber. This was an unforgettable event. It was moving and real and raw, and it explores displacement and queerness, the attitude of the West, writing, poetry, and how grief and rage can feed on you, but also feed you. Enjoy.
Hello, hello, hello everybody. Welcome to the last day of The Coasters Queer. It's really lovely to see you all here. It's been such a fantastic weekend and I'm really delighted that you're here. But now, I can't tell you, that's how my notes start, how pleased I am to introduce this panel of extraordinary writers and translators from Ukraine and Poland. Both countries whose attitude toward its queer citizens is both frightening in the short term and deeply foreboding for the future, I think. The Queer Ukraine anthology describes how those attitudes are exaggerated and magnified in the time of conflict. And look, it's difficult to talk about war in one part of the world and say nothing about what's happening in Gaza and Israel this weekend. There's little that any of us can say, except to offer deep, deep sympathy. But I really hope that we, as a community, are able to stand with all of our LGBTQ brothers and sisters who have personal connections, skin in the game, as they say, in all these conflicts and hold them in love and care and kindness. What encourages hope is the understanding and the insights that we get from the poems, essays, and incredible stories told by people like our panelists today. And so we are so, so privileged to have them here with us, particularly, well, all of you who have traveled from long distances. It's really wonderful. The panel will be chaired by Maria Jastrzębska. Maria came to the UK from Poland as a child and grew up a poet. Her poetry, which good, that was good, good work, that was, yeah. Her poetry collections include the wonderful true story of Cowboy Hat and Ingenue and her most recent Small Odysseys. All of the books are available at the bookstore and everybody hopefully will be signing at the end. So please do and go buy several copies and give them to everybody for Christmas. Look, I'm not going to say any more. Maria is going to introduce the rest of the panel, but thank you very much for coming and enjoy the panel. Thanks.
Oh, welcome everybody to this event, which is a great honour for me, and I'm so excited to showcase these brilliant, amazing writers to you. As Leslie said, you know, it's personal. The invasion of their homeland, the war in their homeland is next door to my homeland. But actually, with all the wars going on at the moment, none of them are really that far away. So this is a really, really, really special event. We're going to be focusing on two books. We've got the Queer Ukraine anthology produced by the Dvika Collective. And we've got a novel, Nadezhda in the Dark, by Yelena Moskovich. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go around and introduce everybody to you kind of one by one, and then we'll have a bit of conversation. And then if we don't run out of time, then we'll take questions from you. So I'm going to start with the anthology. Now, this is a small in the hand volume, but it packs a mighty punch. It's really a treasure box. You know, it's filled with stories and poems, political analysis, reflection. There's queer mythology, there's history, and there's feelings, of course, from shock and disbelief and despair to pride and hope. And I'm going to start with Vlada, who is one of the co-editors of this anthology. And congratulations to all of you for putting it together at such a terrible time and collecting all the different voices. So Vlada, can you start by telling us what you wanted people reading it to know or to learn?
Hi, thank you so much. I mean, thank you all for coming out and thank you for hosting the event as well. Thank you, the Coast is Queer, for having us. It's quite a big question in a way because I was in the diaspora when Russia fully invaded Ukraine in February of 2022. It was my first few months in England. I just started my degree. But there's not much that you can do, it feels like, at least, when something like this happens to your community back home, to which you're tied to. You have family there, you have your siblings there, you have your partners, loved ones. So it was quite, as you said, maybe something of a disbelief, but we don't let that kind of stop us. And right away, as soon as the full-scale invasion broke out, I just started thinking about what can I, as a queer Ukrainian in the diaspora, do that will have the most direct immediate impact, but also will, in a way, archive our life stories, our history, so that in case queer folks in Ukraine are erased by the extremely transphobic and queerphobic colonial war machine of Russia, how will people remember us? So, you know, when the full-scale invasion just broke out, there were reports of kill lists that Russia had of all of the activists within the LGBTQ plus community that were to be targeted in case Ukraine was to be fully occupied. So that kind of fed into this immediate response, something that has to be done right away. But also, as a person in the diaspora, I could not ask people, everyone, to just contribute, because it's something that, you know, not everyone has the resource to write about their immediate danger, about their immediate environment, especially when, like, missiles are falling on you, when you're losing loved ones, when you're getting mobilized, when you're going to right away go on the front line and protect your community, because you know that if you don't, then it's going to be erased. So T, my brother, my twin, and my co-editor, was at the time facing that erasure in Ukraine. And for me, this kind of book presented an opportunity to do two things. Firstly, fundraise, because I'm a big believer that communities like ours, the queer community in Ukraine, can use publishing as a tool for fundraising, because not only does it, for example, collect money right away with like fundraisers, but also it has this kind of prolonged, continuous fundraising effect where people can buy the book and all of this money will still be going back to the community. And thankfully, with this book, we've already raised more than £2,500 for hormones for folks back home, for HIV meds, and for anything, for sheltering queer people. So it's been quite a good example for us, something that hopefully we can disseminate to other communities as like a methodology. When something like this breaks out, if you're in the diaspora of a community that's facing erasure, this is one of the things that you can do to help that community immediately. But also this was in a way to get my queer loved ones back home more occupied on something than the missiles, in a way. And for me, as my twin was there, this was my direct response, like, to get him to write, because he's a writer, but also to get all of these other people to write to shift their perspective as much as they can. You can't shift your perspective away from missiles that are falling on you. But this was kind of the direct, immediate response of mine. And thankfully, we are where we are. And this book has done quite a bit for us and for our community. But yeah, that was kind of the immediate response. But also, it would be great in the long term if it would produce some sort of queer solidarity within the Western queer communities as well, because we felt extremely estranged from them for many different reasons. But as they say, nothing about us without us, and this was one of the examples of that. Like, you can look at that and you can see how our community is feeling. Of course, this is a very kind of small, you know, number of texts and number of people who contributed, and we are a non-homogeneous community as any queer community, so keep that in mind, but it's a good starting point for people who want to understand kind of what queerness during wartime means for people who are actually living it. So that was it, kind of.
Yeah, well, you have achieved something amazing, and as Leslie said, the book's on sale, and I hope everybody's going to buy it. I'm going to move on to introduce you to Tanya, who is one of the contributors. And a big theme in the whole anthology, I think, is that gap between being here and being there, you know, here in the safety and there not. And I think that's very much a theme in your work, Tanya. And you write very movingly. It really touched me what you said about the going back and forth between here and there, and also between adult and child. And I wondered if you could say a bit more about that, because I wondered, you know, what keeps you going in the face of this craziness?
By craziness, do you mean like the going back and forth or the war?
Or the of the situation, but also yeah. There is a craziness, I think, in the back and forth, yeah.
I think I'll answer first to the back and forth sure. bit and then to the what keeps me going. So I think I'm quite a nostalgic person, so I reflect on my past a lot, but also past can be quite a painful thing to reflect on, because we have all like personal traumas, but there is also a collective one that I didn't acknowledge until very recently. And being here and kind of processing that, I grew up in East Ukraine, so it's very Russified, kind of. I spoke Russian growing up and I consumed Russian culture, which in its core is quite xenophobic and kind of anti-Ukrainian. In a way, and I think that's the only thing that I knew, because there was not really access for me to like Ukrainian culture, and even in my space and like in my school, like the first language was Russian, it was a Russian school, I didn't speak my language, I didn't really know my language, I didn't know like any Ukrainian authors, or like I'm still very much discovering it. And it's just that reflection of, it's so easy to say that kind of nationality doesn't matter, until you're kind of denied having one, or told that your nationality is not, you know, as significant as this other nationality. So I've been just reflecting a lot on it and like kind of grieving what could have been if I felt safe like expressing being Ukrainian, and like if I like fought back the kids on holiday, like the Russian kids that called me Khakhlushka, which is a slur for Ukrainians that Russians use, or like, yeah, so I think that's what I've been reflecting on. So I'm kind of going back and forth being here and like being in this, like feeling safe to express that now, but also there is such a gap that I need to fill. And I speak Ukrainian now, even though it's not really ideal Ukrainian, but it feels so much better. And I'm like, I don't feel like I'm trying to be someone else, someone that I'm like, I don't know. And I think about my little brother who's having it even worse than me, because half of his life he spent during wartime, and his childhood is kind of taken away from him in a significant way, because he is Ukrainian. So there is a lot of kind of hard reflections to do on growing up. Like, being a child is hard. Like, it's rough, it's traumatic, especially if you're Ukrainian. So, yeah, that's, I guess, the answer to the first part of the question. And what keeps me going now is definitely the community. Like, my friends here did so much for me because my whole family is in Ukraine. And when the war started, I was in London. And when the war started, I didn't know what to do, so I just went to work. I worked in a pub, and surprisingly, everyone that I worked with in the pub were British, and they didn't know anything. They weren't queer, they weren't anything, but they went with me to every single protest. They covered for me so I can take like 10 smoke breaks in an hour, and they were so nice. And it was such an unexpected alliance in a way, because a lot of the queer community in the West I felt really quite abandoned and betrayed in a way, because they tried to take a stance of neutrality, and you can't really be neutral when a group of people is facing genocide. You can't really be like, oh, it's so complicated, like, oh, but yeah, Russians are struggling too. Like, well, are their homes being destroyed? Are their children being killed? No. So why are you trying to explain to me how I'm supposed to feel? And I think it's just that kind of aspect. And I think people who just knew me immediately as a person, I found a lot more empathy in relationships with them rather than the like big like liberal queer community in UK, which was very sad, but I think we're all kind of recovering from it slowly. But yeah, big thanks to my friends. And yeah, also, I don't know if I'm like talking too much.
I think you're saying exactly, exactly, and that's a lovely answer. And I'm so glad that you've found some community, because that's something we've been talking about at Coast is Queer, and without each other and without community, you know, we're nowhere. But thank you very much. Would you like to read something from the anthology?
This is all like notes app poetry, but Vlada said it was good enough. Fireworks will never sound the same. Part one. I think they've used up all of their rockets. Now we just have to survive. Chemical weapons, maybe 10 atomic bombs. That's it, my little brother stated with relief and fell asleep. Part two. Black Cat of Abney Park. I woke up to a shadow at my bedside. It told me not to be afraid, that soon I will know for certain who I am and who I must never become. Part three. I've grown wary of the night. Nighttime means life or death. Alarm every half an hour, checking the blue screen. Air raid alert, air raid alert, air raid alert. Are you okay? Number four. I lay awake in my childhood bedroom, waiting every night for the explosions and warplanes, and they never come, but the fear always lingers. Since I was 14, it stayed. I'm 22, and my home is on fire, and I'm far away reading the news, false threats, troops at the border. Have a smoke and not know where you'll be in a year. Part five, end. I can feel my memories of home fading. There have been times where I've been away for a year, but this time is different because everything is different. A glimpse of the past stuck on repeat, walking with my sister through the town that raised us, the town that in which we no longer live, still the same, even though we're not. Talking of change, she said she was afraid every time we come back would be the last. I secretly wish we didn't have this conversation. I think everyone could feel it. Feel it breathing down our necks, creeping in with the February wind. The winter is long, cold, and dark. The winter can go on for years. Thank you.
Well, I'm so glad that Vlada chose that for the anthology, because it's beautiful. Thank you very much. I'm going to move on to tea. Tea is one of the contributors to the anthology, but also the co-editor with Vlada. So Tea, congratulations on putting this all together and you know, all the work that you've done for it. I mean, this anthology blew me away completely. And in your contribution, you write about the unsayable, you write about the unbearable. I mean, I think you all do, actually, in different ways. And your writing very much confronts the rest of the world's, and especially the West's, indifference, and that's something Tanya touched on and will probably come back to. And the West's indifference or lack of understanding. I wonder if you could say more about that.
Absolutely. So thank you, everybody, for coming. It's lovely to see some support for something that's been happening for a really long time and for something that unfortunately continues to happen because we were fortunate enough to be blessed with a neighbor as generous as Russia. So to answer the first part of your question, the unbearable and the unsayable, well, that's just grief and rage. That's a lot of grief and a lot of rage that I have never known how to channel elsewhere other than in writing. I think grief and rage, they're something that can really feed you. Of course, they can also like feed on you, but you can utilize them for, I guess, for your own work and for continuing to do work for the communities that matter to you. And they kind of exist in tandem. They have like a bit of a symbiotic relationship. And you don't always understand them, but just like that lack of understanding is not an impediment to writing about it. Like, I don't need to know the source of my rage to put it on paper, or I don't need to like understand the magnitude of my loss to channel it into my work. So that's, I guess, the first part of the question. The second part is about feeling failed or let down or disappointed by the West, which I think remains true for a lot of colonized people. I think it remains true for a lot of people facing oppression, from Ukrainians to Palestinians. And the big part of it is that Ukrainians don't neatly fit into like the Western colonial hegemony. Because, I mean, we weren't colonized by the British. We weren't colonized by the Americans. And a lot of people still refuse to see Russia as an empire. A lot of people, particularly Western leftists, have this idea of like a USSR communist utopia, you know, where everything was just sunshine and rainbows. And it's really interesting to see queer Western leftists valorize the Soviet Union this way, because I know for a fact that those people would not survive in those conditions. Much like Ukrainians did not survive in those conditions. All that, you know, quote-unquote economic progress and all that quote-unquote equality came at the expense of the erasure, mass starvation, torture, forced deportation, and the state-sponsored terror machine of my people. All that quote-unquote success came at the expense of Ukrainian lives. And did anybody do anything? And did anybody do anything in 2014 when Crimea was illegally occupied by Russian forces? So this is 2022, when they've reinvaded us, when they're attempting to recolonize us, when once again we're seeing our people in mass crematoriums, when we're seeing the massacres like in Bucha, when we're seeing what they did to cities like Mariupol, where it's just razed down. So of course there's a lot of rage. Of course there's a lot of rage at the West. But I think in lieu of speaking on my own personal experience, I'm going to quote a soldier, a musician, and a writer whose name is John Object, who since the very first day of the full-scale invasion came to fight so that I could have a safe sky to come back to. European authorities deal with the genocide in the same unwieldy manner as they do with a bus fare dodger. The collective Western left is far too knowledgeable about the wants and needs of a person being murdered by fascists and will happily lecture them on how to die. Shelling a sovereign country daily for a year, deporting its children, executing civilians, seems certainly frowned upon, but generally, these things happen. Yes, the things that should never happen. Thank you.
Spot on, T. Would you like to read from your contribution to the anthology?
Sure. How to be a war refugee in 10 easy steps. Step 1, get out alive. Once you've got out alive, convince yourself that you're a traitor to your homeland. Step 2, somewhere in Ivano-Frankivsk, a boy turns 18. In the morning, he hears his mother's muffled cries through the wool. Step 3, learn about survivor's guilt from a Healthline.com article. Then read Ilya Kaminsky's work until you're a shuddering, sobbing wreck. Step 4, send your rich friends, yes, those rich friends, the satin-skinned, silver-spoon-fed socialites whose Bora Bora holidays and Paris Fashion Week outfits make you want to tie a noose around your neck. Donation links. Block them if they leave you on red. Step 5, repeat step 4 over and over again and again. Congrats, now you're friendless. Step 6, somewhere in Mariupol, a girl teaches her baby brother a magic trick. Heat up snow over a fire and watch it transform into water. Now drink, my sweet angel, drink. Step 7, learn to feed yourself anew. Start with canned soup and saltine crackers. When a street vendor offers you half a kilogram of beetroot, don't think about how much you miss your babusha's borscht. Step 8, scream at a protest. Keep screaming as the journalist takes your picture. Step 9, somewhere in Odessa, civilians pile sandbags around a monument. You may pummel us with shells and gunfire, but you'll never erase the proof of our existence. Step 10, find someone you love. Hold them tight enough to feel your ribs crack. This one's called Pedigree. You say I mostly speak about imagined horrors, so I sit down and write a child's obituary. It's true, I'll celebrate the bruises on my cousin's shoulders and how they give him reason to believe in fortune, the wheel that spins, the spectral strings that move us, the odds that separate the victors from the corpses. I wish I could claim ownership of survival, but last week my dream mother found a suicide note beneath her pillow. My living mother found a bullet. And you can't claim we should have seen this coming when none of us have asked to be a witness. When caution is a song we've long stopped humming. When vigilance is a blood-transmitted sickness. And this is the last entry that I wrote. I wake up and write another war poem. I wield the words like weapons in my hands. The syllables become shrapnel under my skin. Pieces of my flesh have splintered off, got lost in mourning, its ink black ether, its deep murky waters, its irrevocable pull. Once again, my appetite is nowhere to be seen. An apple for lunch is a little feast. Once again, I refuse to stay clean. I shower once a week. Does our agony enthrall you? Is our atrophy appealing? Do you want us printed and hung up on every wall, projected to every screen, exhibited for an audience of leering voyeurs, prying eyes, the more the merrier? Will they laugh along and offer paltry pleasantries, exchange blank stares? Will they care? There's no artistry in a massacre, I want to say. It isn't something we write about, it's something we carry. We taste it on the roof of our mouths each time we swallow. We hear an ambulance and think of alarms. We walk along train tracks and think of deportations. And spectating is an act of cruelty. Instead, I smile and take a bow, get off the microphone, exit the stage. Thank you for coming to this reading. Thank you for listening to the silence between air raid sirens. Thank you for watching us bleed. Thank you for watching. Thank you for watching. Thank you for watching.
Thank you, T. Thank you so much for being so real. I'm going to move on to Yelena Moscovich. Yelena, what the audience don't know about you is that you're actually a magician. And your latest novel, your fourth novel, is set one night in an apartment in Berlin, where two women sit in the dark without speaking, and it appears that nothing happens. But actually, the whole book explodes with stories, with history. It's a kind of whirlpool vademecum. It's a carousel, your own encyclopedic tour of history, both personal and wider. There's hot and horny sex, there's misunderstandings, there's breakdown, there's grief, there are those macabre Slavic jokes that I recognize because we have them in Poland as well. I mean, there's just everything in there. So it's like nothing's happening, but everything's happening. So I was and I'm still am under the spell of this book. Nadezhda in the Dark. I know that you left the Soviet Union as a Jewish refugee yourself, and a common theme through all your novels is immigration, people leaving or being forced to leave their homeland. And I've heard you talk in relation to another book about immigration as death, and I wondered if you could say something about that, because I think that's relevant to everyone and also relevant to your latest book.
Yeah, absolutely. First, I want to thank you all for sharing, and also just to go back, because everything that you said, I just felt so much in my heart and had so much to say about it. But what I wanted to say was I read your book before I was asked to do this event, and I really related to what you said, Tanya, about, like, I grew up, well, until the age of 7 and also Eastern Ukraine, and, you know, speaking Russian, I don't speak Ukrainian, you know, very much, not even growing up on Russian literature, but everything was Russified, like, even, like, Isaac Babel, like, all these Ukrainians that couldn't write in Ukrainian because it just wouldn't be published. So then, like much later, being kind of an older generation, but also it's like I'm looking for myself a lot through literature, and books are a huge community for me and a lot of diaspora because we're so far away. Like my parents are in America, my grandparents were in Israel, I have family in Israel, like Germany, you know, all over. So I think books are this common ground. And I was always looking for, like, queer Ukraine. And then somehow on a Google search, I found this book. And it just gave me so much that I couldn't express in, dialogue that I was having. Not even dialogue, just, I guess, like, emotional outbursts that I was having with friends. And it reminded me the power of books, that like, okay, there was no back and forth, even though I was reading it, and I was like, yeah, I wish I could, you know, talk to you. But so then when I was asked to do this event, I was like, whoever's up there is listening to me, or I don't know. So I just wanted to say that, like, the community through books, so important, and has always been. Even growing up, my grandfather was a literature teacher, and my mom was a poet, but she couldn't publish in the Soviet Union, so only started self-publishing. She's very private, very paranoid, different trauma, but what was I saying? So just like books were more my closest friends and my closest confidants from an early age. And then kind of switching back, maybe this is a bit of a jarring jump to Immigration is Death. My third book, A Door Behind the Door, my other books are a bit more, I guess, magical realist, or play with the different dimensions of reality. And it's literally these immigrants, mainly Jewish Ukrainian immigrants, but that's, we don't necessarily know where, but where in Ukraine, but they literally have to die or are killed to then all of a sudden not even be reborn, because they don't start from childhood. But there's this one woman that is stabbed to death mysteriously by a boy that doesn't even know why he did it. He doesn't want to do it, but he says like math made him do it. Like he had to count for some reason. And then all of a sudden like reappears again in the Midwest, like drinking a milkshake. And now her name is Sally. And she has to remember that her name is Sally, you know. Anyway, so I think immigration as a death, like literal death, but also in terms of the word departed, you know, there is a departure in terms of leaving, but you automatically become the departed, you know, the one who died, who has to leave. And it's like this, you leave, but the leaving is never done. And I also think of the Soviet poet Marina Tsvetaeva, who, huge influence on my work, but also said, to be dead, there's no need to die. And so just the separation of like the phenomenology of death and the, I guess, finality or act of death. And I think, immigration, it's like this, I think, ontological dissonance between, you know, that you can live simultaneously in different times, in different places, and in different realms, that you can live. Sometimes I think of theater, like what's really amazing about theater is you can have a space between heaven and hell, and, you know, especially like Greek drama. And so immigration is sort of that, like suddenly planes open up to your mortality and immortality, because there's a death that will keep on dying. I had so much to say. Oh, but also I wanted to add in terms of writing. So I live in France and kind of grew up in France, did my higher education in France. So a lot of French writers and thinkers influenced me. But a great kind of feminist thinker, Hélène Cixous, has a book all about like writing and death. And she says, writing is learning to die. And I think about writing as also a sort of immigration. Like, how do you get to the page? How do you get to a word that like will suffice?
Totally, I think a lot of us feel that we live in more than one place or more than, you know, simultaneously. I think that's very true for migrants, but I think it's true for many people. You know, whether it's partly our childhood or partly another geographical place. There are two characters in your latest book who are both migrants, and one is Ukrainian, one is Russian, and they fall in love and they have their ups and downs. I don't know, do you feel there's any sort of rebirth through that, through relationship, through connection
Yeah, well, the characters were very close to me and based on my own experience, but what I was kind of wary of, almost I wish that I had lived it differently, is I kind of hate this forced binaryism between, like, ooh, a Ukrainian woman and a Russian woman. However did they, you know, find love? So I, but it's also the, you know, complexity of it. It's more about the complexity of a history that they share, because they both, of my generation, they left during the Soviet Union. The Ukrainian was a Jewish refugee. The Russian immigrated by choice, although you find in her background that, you know, also had a certain urgency, but you can't compare it to a sort of forced immigration. And so, yeah, I think these characters, and also their discrepancies in understanding even the history of the Soviet Union, and understanding, the same, like, maybe similar to this, like, Western fetishism with communism that I see, especially a lot in France, like, you know, this communist flag. I'm like, that, you know, that's this, you know, like, that this communism was some sort of ideal, and it, the, you know, the Russian, that the Russian and Soviet government were such a failure, and were just so, that never even reached a communism, that somehow became such a, like, a glorified and ideal structure in the West, something to live up to and to defend in a way. And so that also kind of speaks to the difference between them, of learning what events, you know, even what things, what rituals, what traditions, what things have this sort of glory attached, and where it's false or where it's actually quite bloodied, and what do you do, you know, with that when it's become sacred to you personally or to your family?
It's very, very true. I mean, in this country, there was lots of, you know, you could buy Soviet paraphernalia, and it was seen as kind of rebellious to wear it. And, you know, when you come from East European or Central European context, that isn't really a rebellion. It's kind of, you know, so, I totally get what you're saying. I've got one more question for you, Yelena, and then we'll ask you to read something. I write lots of poems that look like prose, but you've written a whole novel which looks like a poem. Could you say something about why this novel is like that?
I've always been attracted to kind of novel and prose, or novel and verse, sorry. I grew up very much on, like, Pushkin, like, Eugene Onegin. Not so much for, you know, that's also, whatever, complex, like, historical context. But in terms of the form, in terms of the fact that, you know, narration can use different spaces and times, and can have different densities. What I really love about poetry is, it makes me think of Joseph Brodsky, who's also a Jewish Russian immigrant poet, who said that poetry is language fighting against its own mass and density. And there's something about that where, you know, in prose, you have a lot more that's explicit, a lot more that's on the surface. And of course, you have this subtext, but the subtext is almost following the direction of whether it's like a linear story, but there's something that's moving forward. Whereas in a poem, things can hover and move every direction all at once, and there's more that's withheld than written. And so I always was attracted to this intersection of how a novel can kind of use the space of poetry. And it's funny because when I write, you know, this novel, like, my novels are quite, like, experimental in terms of form, but when I write poetry, I actually like really formal structures, like sonnets. And so, because Yeah, it's the opposite. It's like borrowing a different time, I guess. I kind of like lost my way in the maze. I don't know if I got back, if I found the centaur in the middle.
You did answer. Would you like to read us an extract?
Yes, I would love to. So I'm going to start with a bit of the beginning. I'm reading from a couple of different sections because the novel, so it's a poem novel and it's actually all one sentence, and you'll hear that it jumps around a lot in time and in basically, like Maria said, like these two women sit in the dark, nothing really happens because the plot is very vertical. It's all about, you know, centuries of history between them, and they have to somehow speak or move through that. And also just to note, Nadezhda means hope in Russian, so it's this kind of wordplay of, you know, Nadezhda, the woman, and also hope in the dark. Nadezhda, her hair hangs like milk, like thick, dark milk, her face in profile, her forehead crescent. There's the tip of her nose sticking out from the thickness of her milky hair on the darkest hour of the darkest day of a Berlin black milk winter. The trees crack in the wind. The puddles catch the black sky, trickle it downstream along the curb, and slick the bars of the iron gutter with it. I don't mean to slyly conjure up a prison, as if to imply that Nadia and I live in a prison. Nadia and I do not live in a prison. We are free. We know people who live in a prison, people our age who have lived in a prison and go on living in a prison. They are not free. We are here in our bedroom, sitting knee to knee. Nadinka and I like to dance to kitsch Russian techno-pop from the 90s. Maybe it's that Gorbachev gap where you could go far with innuendo. I don't know any culture that mixes party time with despair as well as the Slavs, except naturally the Jews. Dancing was a great alternative to sex for Nadia and I. When I asked her if she's horny, sometimes she tells me she's been waiting for me to drip into her mouth all day, though sometimes she answers, no. And if we both feel secure with that, we let it be. And if I hesitate with my expression, she quickly adds, but I'll fuck you good tomorrow. I prefer just the no. I don't want to be fucked good tomorrow. I want to be honest today. There's a tactic to expansion. You clear the land and repopulate it with your own, like Russia did with the coast by the White Sea, with the Finns and Estonians, or the deportation of the Balkars, Chechens, Ingush, Crimean Tatars, Karachays, the forced settlement programs, the Sovietization of the Koryaks, Nenets, Mansi, Sakha, indigenous communities. The name Siberia comes from the Tatar word meaning sleeping land. There was a language to the natural territory. There were shamans, and the earth had a voice, the deer had a voice, the bear had a voice, children removed from their families. Abduction and execution of community leaders. There were strict laws to civilize the rest. Owning a drum would get you executed. Meanwhile, in the 1930s, in the Sovietized Western territories, the Man of Steel conceived a great way to kill off a nation under the name of agriculture. Part of Ukraine's wealth is its soil, beloved soil, new laws for the so-called sake of fairly sharing resources. The confiscation of Ukrainian grain production, the golden fields, wheat and corn that grow so well, stocked and transferred into Russia. Soldiers went into homes and boxed up household groceries, methodologically skimming all food sources from the people. A man-made famine, the Holodomor, meaning kill by starvation. It was no secret. The world watched and the world saw. International aid was continuously offered and continuously rejected by the Soviet government, who watched and who saw.
The NKVD, now KGB, still have control of the archives, but scholars estimate between 3.5 and 8 million Ukrainians starved to death in peacetime with an abundance of food. Nadinka's mama, who claims she is not a political person, then makes it a point to bring up war at the dinner table, has a dulcet, dove-like voice. I can't imagine her hitting Nadinka as a child. I try to remind myself who she has been to Nadia, while she slides more beef pilmeni onto my plate and tops up the sour cream on the side. She is a violent woman. I tell myself, she tells me softly that I should please help myself. She has more on the stove. She serves Nadia in the same gentleness, though Nadia reminds me often that her mama hates the fact that she put on weight. Nadinka was always her little ballerina. Who wants to be a ballerina, I tell Nadia, when they can be a dyke, I wink. At the end of my phrase, I'm not good at winking, but I'm trying it out. I don't want to die without improving my wink. Nadia's mama is talking about a war that doesn't exist. She refers to it as it should be referred, as she claims, not as a war, but as a special operation. She likes my earrings and hates fake media. There's this joke, and it goes like this. Nurse, the young man says, where are we going? To the morgue, the nurse answers. But nurse, the young man says, I haven't died yet. Well, the nurse places her palm gently on his shoulder. We haven't arrived yet. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's fantastic. I'm going to talk to all of you now, or ask all of you some more questions before we open it up. You know, at Coastis Queer, we talk a lot about being a very diverse family, and as Vlada said, you know, we're not a homogenous group, and you're not a homogenous.
Mike.
Sorry, it's too much excitement. You were talking about when you know we're not a homogenous group, and one of the things we talked about earlier with you was about sort of differences between being queer in Ukraine and being queer in the West, and I wondered if you wanted to say something, any of you, about that.
I mean, I can start. It's a wonderful question, but I guess everyone will have a lot to say about that. You know, I don't want to take too much time because we could have this discussion forever and ever.
I know.
Very complex discussion, I guess. But at the baseline, it's as such that in my experience and in the experience of many of my friends who are queer diaspora, not just from Ukraine, it could be Eastern Europe, Central Europe, it could be, let's say, just non-Western world. There's this feeling that there's a sort of queerness that's pushed onto you. We call it Western sexual exceptionalism, because while queer theory has been dominated by Western authors, there's this feeling that because of that, everyone needs to fit in a certain category of what queerness is, particularly to this Western dominant narrative, while queerness in its expressions is extremely different elsewhere. So I guess that's the very baseline of it. And we haven't felt as welcomed here because our queerness is messy, especially in wartime. Our queerness is not something that transgresses just yet, and that's okay for us, because you cannot transgress, let's say, you cannot go beyond gender, you cannot go beyond certain little things that make up your identity if that identity is continuously taken away. Just like in a wonderful book by Jasbir Puar, The Terrorist Assemblages, they talk a lot about homonationalism and what that means, they coined the term, and even though the contexts are extremely different, there's this understanding that we are othered within the dominant Western queer canon, just because the way we live queerness is different to the way it is expressed here. And I always thought that it's something that is quite open and should not be codified under one kind of dominant narrative, but that's just not the experience I have of being queer in the UK so far. So that's just kind of a very base, very base.
Thank you. Can any of you say a bit more about what characterizes being queer in Ukraine that you feel is different?
Needless to say, I think it's important to acknowledge that it's not technically like the mecca of queer rights, right? When you think of like, where am I going to take my partner for like sexy vacation? You don't think, oh, hey, let's go to Eastern Europe. which, hey, maybe that's going to change. Let's hope it changes. I would love for Ukraine to be a mecca for all the weird queers of the world. But first we have to win. And so much of Ukrainian queerness is under the cracks. So much of it is just like a little like seedling, you know, just like kind of rooting through and slowly but surely growing, slowly but surely spreading. But it's spreading. And the kind of queerness that I was exposed to was in these kind of underground bastions of resistance and solidarity. A lot of clubbing that I did was very just kind of like super, super tolerant, super queer, you know, by the LGBTQ community, for the LGBTQ community. And it was always just such an interesting environment to be in because, you know, you'd be queuing in line to this club at 2 a.m. and all the people in front of you were like in business attire or just like these really kind of fancy, quote unquote, cis heteronormative modes of presentation. You get inside the club, everything comes off, and suddenly there's like leather harnesses, like nipple rings, assless chaps, and you're like, on one hand, it is devastating and tragic that we have to wear this person suit to cover up who we actually are. But on the other hand, it's so beautiful that I get to see who you actually are. And it's so beautiful that we exist in this fringe together. Whereas in the West, I can walk into Tesco in June and see a rainbow flag. And I'm like, wow. I feel uplifted. So I guess that's the kind of difference that I've observed.
But also, if I can very quickly follow up, like, T spoke about these seedlings, right? About the fact that you feel like something's brewing, there's this energy. But the, I guess, main point that it would be great to understand is that it doesn't have to go the same way that queerness progressed in the West. You know, like, this is kind of the point that we're trying to make as well, because like it has to be decentralized. You cannot centralize something like, let's say, a queer community or queer modes of presentations. Like, it would be interesting to see where it goes. For that, we need freedom and no occupation, of course. But it doesn't have to go the same kind of way of progress that, let's say, what you see now, the way it's like performed here in the UK. Like, it can go a very different kind of road, and that's completely fine, and that's just something that we want people to be okay with, because that's just how it is in a way, you know?
And that makes it exciting as well. Anybody want to add to that, or?
I mean, I think Vlada and Sia are very literate and like academic on the subject. My observations are more simple, but I guess it fits in with just different mentalities with like UK and West, and then contrasted to Eastern Europe. I guess the concept of like queer joy is still really wild to me, because some people can come up to you, like not come up, but there's that statement of queer joy is radical. And then I look at what my queer friends are doing in Ukraine, kind of being in the trenches fighting Russians with a gun, and I'm like, oh, really? That's great. So I think we're all just quite depressed, and that's that's a part of the queer experience in Ukraine, I think. And that's, yeah, I don't know. I think just, and also like the expression, I think in UK at least, like that's the rainbow capitalism that you have, yeah, as you said, when you walk into Tesco's and you see a rainbow flag and you're like, yeah, I'm accepted. In Ukraine, we don't have that. I wouldn't say like I can define like what a gay person looks like when I go back home. Like there's not really any of that. A lot of people will be attracted to the same sex or like have relationships with the same sex in some way and then still not have a label of like, oh, I'm gay or I'm a lesbian, like stuff like that. It's very fluid in a way, but also you don't have to have a label in a way. You don't have to identify as queer or like come out of the closet. I don't, I'm just rambling on. I don't know if I'm making sense, but.
You're making perfect sense.
Yeah, thanks.
A tiny bit of time left. One other question I wanted to ask you, and it's a question that's come up in on other panels as well, is about the pressure to be representational, the pressure to be some kind of an ambassador. Do you think that being a queer writer necessarily means that you're a political writer? How do you feel about in any of that, or you know, how you see your roles?
I really like what Vlada said in terms of, you know, the spectrum of voices and perspectives within a community, but also within one person in different phases of their lives, or just, you know, the unifying aspect of all humans is that we hold contradiction. I know personally, in my heart, and I think in my art, life comes before ideology. So I think intellectually, I can agree, disagree, have different frameworks, but it depends on, you know, where I'm meeting, where I'm having a common ground with a human or with humanity, which is my priority, or I try to make it my priority, because obviously things get very emotional, and a way not to feel helpless is to feel smart. I like to feel smart, you know. So sometimes it's really hard to give up feeling smart, but it's also really important to feel helpless with somebody else. And I realized the value of that over like intellectual superiority or a comprehensive intellectualism, like, oh, I know it all. And yeah, in terms of in my art, it's sort of the same way. So I think political is not necessarily the right word for it. I think it's just very dedicated to human life and the what we can do as beings that are alive with language, and not necessarily how we continue the canon, but what do we need language to be?
Just to add to that, I guess speaking of contradictions, I'm not that big on humanist values, but that's okay. I think especially now that's something that should be talked about. But in a way, like, of course, we don't want to be politicized just for being queer. Yeah, that's just kind of, like, we want to exist within whatever it is, ideology or whatever that we want to exist in. Like, you don't want someone to tell you who you are based on, like, your identity marker, right? Yet, it is extremely important, in a way, as I see it, and of course, this relates differently to other minority groups within the queer umbrella, but in the UK, even within this rise of the fascist rhetoric, not even the rise, it's been rising for years and years and years. Now we're living it, and saying that it's coming is not really true, because people have been dying for years now for being queer, for being trans, especially the trans women in our communities. It is important that we are acting on that it's not just about writing about it. Writing is extremely important, but we have to mobilize as a community as well, because no one is going to save us until we actually start doing the work that matters. So, like, this is, I guess, referring to T's comment and Tanya's comment on just, like, queer joy. Why we can't really get to it is because queer joy is not going to liberate you from fascism. It is an important aspect of our community, absolutely. And it's important to be joyful in the face of all of these things that are trying to bring you down. But there's also something that we need to do practically. Like, queerness is, for me, a praxis. Like, it's something that you do. It's not just something that you talk about or that you just feel. It has to be embodied. And, of course, there's different degrees of, like, how much we can give to this, like, struggle for our collective or independent communities' liberation, but it's something that we have to act on, because our inaction, for whatever reasons, and it's not something that has to be critiqued, but it has led us here, and we have to mobilize in a way, and that's a political issue, and unfortunately, whether, like, I want it or not, that's something that's going to affect me, so I need to act on it, just my politics. And just speaking on that, just if I can say one very last thing, and I'm sorry, the person who introduced us, could I know your name, please? Leslie. Like, as Leslie brought up right in the beginning, you know, like, this is a panel that deals with war, queerness in wartime, and there's a lot of communities that are dealing with queerness in wartime right now, and for me, it's extremely important to be in solidarity with those that are directly affected, immediately affected by these wars. And as someone who was very lucky to work with a Palestinian queer community that is in East Jerusalem right now, I just wanted to say that in discourse on anything that's going on, it would be really important for people to just keep in mind that this simple sentence, there is nothing about us without us. Please listen to those who are immediately affected without kind of putting in your, you know, kind of opinion on that. Sorry?
Would you mind just saying that again?
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to say that there's nothing about us without us. That's just the most important thing for me, and I guess for many other siblings who I'm in solidarity with. It has to come from them, and then we can amplify it or do whatever it is that we want to do with it. But just remember who is most affected in times of genocide, in times of wartime, starvation, erasure. Those people are the ones that need to be at the forefront of their struggle and not us.
Absolutely.
Can I just add one last little thing? I thank you, Vlada, for bringing that up, because I think it's an important point. And I just also wanted to say that action looks like very many different things. And I think with a lot of the justice movements that have been going on, also just be wary not to compare different actions or not to, you know, like when. Because I grew up in America, just certain things that are, for example, expected of African Americans in terms of discourse or action that don't take into account, you know, what's like their own safety, depending on where they are, and that you need to feel safe enough to give, that we can support our brothers, sisters, siblings. In various, you know, that safety is also not assured necessarily in the West, and people give what they can give, and if you can't give for a time or can, you know, whatever, this or that, to always, hold appreciation and hold people that are putting themselves on the front lines in your heart. The minimum, I would say.
Absolutely, and I think this event will help us to hold you all in our hearts. I'm sure of that.
Thank you so much for listening. This was the final episode in our series in collaboration with the Coasters Queer Festival. If you want more engaging queer conversations, you will have to come along. Again, it's from the 10th to the 13th of October in Brighton. You can get 20% off tickets using the code POD20. We hope to see you there.